Before coming to Holden Village, I never went to a worship service that had slides as part of it, or perhaps the most important part of it. And perhaps before coming to Holden Village, none of you have come to, you know, a report on travel where there were not slides, but that's what you're going to have. You know, there's something inappropriate about taking a camera to China anyway. W.H. Auden comments from time to time that he thinks the camera is evil. And the reason he thinks the camera is evil is because it sort of captures people and sort of freezes them, objectifies them, and makes them into something and reduces them thereby, you know, to this one frozen image. At any rate, he thinks that diminishes personhood. And the Chinese, as I understand it, at least the older and more traditional Chinese, have a similar point of view. They believe that if you take a picture of them, you're really taking something away from them. And I had a camera with me, but I used it very little. But I did observe very often people just shying away from the camera, really, really offended when their picture was taken. So in some sense, I was glad that I was not equipped with good photographic equipment. But in another sense, I really regret that I don't have a lot of pictures. The experience of going to China was, among other things, intensely visual. And I would like to have that kind of record. Philo the Jew tells a story, an allegory, an elaborate allegory, in trying to sort of make Jewish thought Greek. He tells an allegory about ears becoming eyes. So I think that for this evening we'll sort of crank it backwards and make our eyes back into ears and see if we can understand something. Let me begin by making clear to all of you that I'm not an expert on China or on Asia, nor am I a representative of one of those disciplines, such as economics or political science, which makes it its business to analyze affairs in present-day China. I also, you know, should make clear that what I understood and so on was very limited by the fact that I do not know Chinese language. And so, of course, I was pretty well at the mercy of the interpreters and translators. And then finally, that I was only there for a short time. However, I think that this visit had enough of an eye-opening impact on me, taught me, I think, a lot, to make it worthwhile to spend a few minutes telling you about my experiences and telling you about some of the things that I've thought about since having been there, which seemed to me to be important for all of us who are citizens of this world to think about. Now, because I'm not trying to be an analyst of China, I think the best way for me to get this across is just to informally and anecdotally tell you about my experiences, kind of to stop at, you know, those points where I think some real issues come into focus, and then perhaps we can talk. Now, I think that some people here have also visited China, not quite so recently, and so we can perhaps have the benefit of some comparative glimpses of China as a way to see whether or not some of the extraordinary claims being made about the great progress in China now have any basis in fact. Now, I visited China last November. I was traveling throughout Asia with a group of students from Augustana College. And when we left this country, It was not part of our itinerary to visit the People's Republic. We had, in planning the trip, tried to arrange for a visit to the People's Republic, and we had been in frequent contact with the liaison office in Washington, D.C., and always to no avail. There was... I'm just going to sit down, or do you have a...
Absolutely.
What? Well, she's got it. Look, she said it.
Not to the house.
Well.
Should I take one from last week, too?
No.
No. Why not? Oh, 70 cents. Why don't
well, not, it? Not just tonight, okay?
Okay. 50 cents.
Okay. You know, I mean, we had a meeting this afternoon about teenagers and parents, you know, but I mean, they've got nothing. A negotiation here about past due allowance. He says, I didn't know about that. At any rate, we have been trying to arrange for our group to make a visit to the People's Republic of China and been in regular contact with the liaison office in Washington, D.C., and every contact we made, we were just thwarted in one way or another. Very polite, very interested in our group, apparently, but I mean, it was clear that the door was always closed, you see. In various ways, we tried to be persistent, and finally, it was said, if indeed you want your group to go to China, you will have to write directly to Peking. Now that was contrary to every bit of advice we had ever received before, but we thought, why not, and sent a letter to Peking and indicated that we would be traveling with a group this fall, and would it be possible for us to visit the People's Republic? We were very interested in what they were doing. Well, the way the program works, some faculty participants don't leave until after the group has already been on their way for a little while, and I was one of those faculty participants. So it happened that after most of the group had left the country, we got a letter from Peking saying we'd be delighted to have the Augustana College Study Group visit the People's Republic of China. Merely contact our liaison office in Washington 3 months before the group leaves the country and provide them with the following set of biographical data about each person. We'll arrange for the issuing of visas. Well, of course, that was impossible, and we assumed, in light of our previous experience, that this was simply a Chinese way of saying no without really saying no. However, we made an effort to contact the liaison office, and by then, and this was middle of September, place didn't have a telephone anymore, and we couldn't, you know. The number that we had called before was disconnected. We tried to make contact. The telephone company couldn't tell us a number. We contacted the State Department and asked them if they could put us in contact, and they said certainly, and gave us a phone number for the Republic of China. Republic of China is Taiwan. They say they're China, the People's Republic of China says they're not, and they're not really on good terms with each other. But we called, believing we were calling the liaison office of the People's Republic, and had what turned out to be a fairly embarrassing conversation before, you know, we realized, you know, your congressman is supposed to help, and we asked them if they in their office, and they did, and put us in contact with the Turkish embassy. So that was, so we left, and on the plane on the way over, we said, well, what should we do? And I said, well, why don't we simply send a cable to Peking and tell them, you know, thank you, and we're on our way, and we'll pick up our visas when we get to Hong Kong and see what happens. So we sent a very long cable, and they wanted a statement about what Augustana College was and what the purpose of the group was, and they wanted biographical data about each participant, you know, and we sent this all off. And then, you know, we were in Japan for a while, and then we were in Taiwan. And of course, when we were in Taiwan, absolutely no possibility of any kind of contact. Then we went on to the Philippines, and there is a diplomatic exchange between Manila and Peking, and we talked to the embassy in Manila, and they said, well, this is the most outlandish and more or less offensive thing that we've ever heard. Of course you can't. How do you, you know, get off trying to act like that? And so we then went into Hong Kong, pretty sure that we wouldn't be able to visit. Well, upon arriving in Hong Kong, at any rate, we contacted the appropriate office, and they said, oh yes, everything's set. Just bring your passports down, and we'll ship them up to Peking and have them stamped. And that's all there is to it. We later discovered that it had been published in the Chinese language newspapers in Hong Kong that Augustana College was sending a large group up to visit the People's Republic, and so most people in Chinese-speaking Hong Kong knew about our visit before we did. We were still apprehensive because we had been to Taiwan, and we thought perhaps, having been there and having had passports stamped, that we were in the Republic of China, that they would not wish to put their visas into our passports. And so it wasn't until our passports came back that we were assured that things were okay. They didn't stamp in our passport, by the way. They stamped the visa on a separate piece of paper, which they paper-clipped in. Now, when you go to the People's Republic of China, this is the way it is now, and even with the recently announced development of a kind of tourism industry in China, I'm sure it's going to be the same way. You don't choose where you're going to go. You don't plan anything about your itinerary or your accommodations or the cost or any of that sort of thing. You simply, you know, ask for permission to go. They tell you that you're going to go, and they tell you where to enter the country. And they tell you how long you'll be there and about how much money you'll need and nothing else. So we entered the People's Republic of China knowing that we would be there for 6 days not knowing anything else about the character of our visit or, you know, what our accommodations would be or what we would be allowed to see or not see and so on and so forth. Entering China from Hong Kong is an experience that in itself is exciting. You ride the regular train out of Hong Kong. Some of you perhaps are not familiar with the geography of Hong Kong. Hong Kong actually has three separate parts. There's Hong Kong proper, which is a large island. This island was ceded by the Chinese to Great Britain during the Opium Wars. Then there was another part on the so-called Kowloon Peninsula of the mainland, which was permanently ceded to Great Britain some few years later. And then there's a street called Boundary Street, and beyond that there's an area called now the New Territories, which is only leased to Great Britain, to the Crown Colony of Hong Kong, until 1999 from the People's Republic. Now, there's a lot of speculation about what's going to happen to Hong Kong when that lease expires in 1999. That's only 21 years from now. Most people that I've talked to assume that Hong Kong in its entirety will become part of China. Those parts which were permanently ceded to Great Britain simply cannot survive without the willing cooperation of China. I mean, you know, for things like water and food and fuel and so many things, Hong Kong is utterly dependent on the People's Republic, on the mainland. So it'll be a matter of some sort of rhetorical adjustment so that China can incorporate this very capitalistic society into its own society. China uses the international banking community and trade community in Hong Kong to its great advantage now, and they really want that, but there's, you know, for obvious reasons, no open discussion about the way in which Hong Kong makes use of China. Most analysts think that when the lease expires, that political rhetoric will have advanced enough so that somehow Hong Kong can be incorporated into China itself. At any rate, the way it is now, you ride the train from Kowloon Station out through the New Territories. And the New Territories, by the way, are a fascinating place to visit because it's like visiting old China. It is not modern at all. Practices of old China, which have been outlawed in China itself now, such as the use of rickshaws and so on, you still see practiced very, very much in the so-called New Territories. It's very, very rural. It looks like, you know, the old Chinese landscape paintings, and you have the illusion there, just 10 minutes from the airport that you're in old China. You come to the last village in the New Territories, and the train stops. The tracks go ahead. One time, you know, you could take a train from Hong Kong all the way to Moscow and then over to Paris. The trains stop now in Shum Chun, the last border community in Hong Kong, and everybody gets off, and you go through Hong Kong customs, well, that's British customs, and then you come out of a building and you walk on the bridge across the river dividing the New Territories from China. The tracks run there too, you see, but no trains cross it. And you walk along this long bridge, and it's a very eerie thing, you see, and you really feel that you're leaving one world and entering another, and the red flag is up ahead, and the Hong Kong and British flags are behind, and you file through, and then enter into the People's Republic that way. I mentioned that our visas were on separate pieces of paper, which were paper clipped into the passports. All of us thought we'd like to have some kind of permanent official souvenir that we had visited, and we were concerned that maybe on the way out or something these visas would be lifted so that there wouldn't be any permanent record in our passport showing that we had been both to Taiwan and the People's Republic. But we found out very quickly, no, that we can keep these visas and so on. They stamped our admission to the People's Republic on the visa and we went on. I got the bright idea that maybe it would be worth asking if they would just stamp, you know, in my passport that I had been admitted to China. And so I went back and approached the Red Army guards, very stern, you know, sort of austere looking men, and said, when I entered, you didn't stamp my passport. I wonder, and immediately they were very excited, how did he slip in, you know, that they didn't realize that I meant that, you know, you had stamped the visa, but you hadn't stamped the passport. And they quickly looked and saw that well, the visa was stamped. They said, no, you know, it's right here, it's okay. And I said, no, I know that it's stamped there, but what I would like is to have it stamped in my passport itself. And again, they said, no, it's okay, you don't need to do any more. And I said, well, I know it's okay, but you see, I really want this. Just for my sake, not for yours. And, well, the Chinese have a kind of sense of humor, because the guard takes my passport, and he looks away from it, and he opens it like this till the page where the Taiwan visa is, and he holds it up like this, and he says, you have to understand the meaning. Without ever looking at it. And so that was his way of saying, you know, we're not officially acknowledging anything about the existence of Taiwan. At least diplomatically, you know, we're going to not let it be known that we realize that there is that other place over there that claims to be China, and all of you have been there, and so on and so forth. And we have been told, by the way, and I'll say something about this in a few minutes, that while we were in the People's Republic, that it would really be bad form to talk about Taiwan and to talk about you know, the things we had seen there, and to talk about, say, nature of agricultural reform there as opposed and compared to agricultural reform in the People's Republic, or, and this would be the lowest, you know, thing of all, to talk about the collection at the Palace Museum, which is a marvelous collection of Chinese antiquities. It's a huge place. I think there's some other people here that have been there. A huge place. Just really, I mean, talk about collections of jade or collections of ivory carvings and so on. Just room after room after room after room. When Chiang Kai-shek fled, you know, I mean, they just grabbed every treasure they could find and scooted across the Sound with it. There's nothing comparable left in China. And so it's, and by the way, I mean, only a third of the collection is ever on display in Taiwan. The rest of it is hidden away in mountain caves, guarded, because the Taiwanese people are very much afraid that they're going to be invaded by the mainland, and they assume that one provocation, perhaps, or at least one of the results of such an invasion would be the pillaging of the museum, so that much of the stuff is hidden away. At any rate, we were told never to mention anything about Taiwan and what we saw there, and so on. We found out later that one needn't be that strict. In fact, we were asked by a number of Chinese people, what's it like? Well, we were met by a couple of guides or interpreters who were assigned to our group. Career people working out of Peking, very, very fluent in English, very knowledgeable, and very, very clear on the party line, and very clear on the party line down to the last revision. As you know, China's undergoing sort of another kind of cultural revolution currently. It's a cultural revolution which they want to, you know, be done publicly. They want, and I think the move to develop tourism now is a way to let this sort of re-education of the people be done in full view of the rest of the world. But the Gang of Four, as they were called, had been kicked out, and Chairman, as I put it, our wise Chairman Hua had been put in control, and there was a number of questions about how certain policies were really consistent with Mao Zedong thought and so on, and our chief interpreters were just very well versed in this, and couldn't be, at least by any of us, gotten off track at all. At any rate, we were met and we sat down in a room in the railway station before we went and said, well, he said, now you're here in our country, what would you like to see? We said, well, we're interested in just seeing all sorts of things. We'd like to see industry, and we'd like to see agriculture, and we'd like to see schools, and we'd like to see hospitals, and we'd like to visit communes, and so on. And he said, well, that's what we thought, and we have the following planned for you. And he had a very nice little tour set up for us, and all of those kinds of things we were able to visit, and I'll talk about those visits in a minute. I was impressed that our interpreters had a big dossier on us with them. All of the things that we had sent up in our cable had been translated into Chinese, and they had, you know, I saw there my name written in Roman letters and then half a page of Chinese characters, I presume, saying exactly everything that I had said about myself. They also had translated the statement that we had sent about Augustana College, but more interestingly, perhaps, they had another long, long statement about Augustana College. I mean, apparently somebody at some point in this visa-getting process had done some research on Augustana College, and in conversation we later found out that they knew a lot about Augustana College that we never told them, and they knew a lot about the community where Augustana is located. They knew For example, that the international headquarters of John Deere manufacturers is in the same town. That was of interest to them because John Deere at that time was cooking up a deal to sell farm implements and so on. So they had all these kind of connections, and they just knew a lot about us. Now, what that says, I don't know. It certainly says something about the extent to which China is a free society. And the extent to which they trust visitors, and so on. But I can't do more than speculate, really, about that. We, in our trip, didn't get very far into China. We centered our visit exclusively around the southern city of Canton. Canton is a very interesting city in Chinese history. It is a kind of port. It's not a very good port. The river runs down from Canton to Hong Kong, about 80 miles or so to the south. Some shipping has been possible up and down that river, but it never worked out very well because it's a shallow river and so on, so heavy kinds of shipping was never possible. But it's a fairly industrial city. It's a city that was a provincial capital. Well, it is a provincial capital. It has been a provincial capital. It's a city where, which is known for a kind of center of dissidence. And a lot of the important rebellious movements of the intelligentsia in Chinese history have either begun in Canton, or Canton has played an important part in it. One of the things we saw in Canton, therefore, with that historical note in mind, was really the place where the Communist Revolution began. There was the National Peasants Training Institute, which was held there, and Mao Zedong lectured there, and they have the place now preserved as a kind of memorial to the young Mao, and they have everything, and that he left behind, his clothes and so on, but I mean also his washcloth and things like this. And as we're touring around, this is the washcloth that Chairman Mao used when he was a teacher at the National Peasant Institute, and so on. Visiting that institute was one of our first stops, and what struck me as I went through that was the absolute fervor and sort of intenseness of the young guides who were showing us around. I don't run in a crowd where there are a lot of people who are really zealots or very, very intensely committed to something. So perhaps my comparisons here are not really valid, but I at least have never been in the presence of anybody who seemed so absolutely committed and intense and just really burning, you see, with a kind of passionate conviction as I had when I saw these guys. And then that experience was just repeated over and over and over again. If the revolution is wearing thin, as some China analysts say, and this is a concern, that they can't keep the spirit of the revolution going, you sure don't notice it when you talk to the people that they have out front, at least. And, there was a kind of conviction that, and really burning zeal that, in my experience, was unprecedented. A lot of monuments around Canton. An interesting one was the Sino-Soviet Friendship Monument. In one of the people's parks, the guides were trying to lead us through the park in a way where we wouldn't pass by it. We had done our homework and knew it was there, and so we kind of walked over, and there we stood right at the foot of this large Sino-Soviet friendship monument, and asked then, what is this? Oh, well, that's nothing very important, we were told. Well, but isn't this the Sino-Soviet friendship monument? Well, yes, but we're re-landscaping this part of the park now, and it's really not something that we include on these tours. And very, very evasive about this. And we pressed them from time to time about the character of relationships between China and the Soviet Union. And we were finally told that, no, the Russians are worse than the Americans. We have to make a distinction between the people and the governments. And the people of your country and the people of the Soviet Union are great, but the current regime in the Soviet Union is worse even than the Americans. We visited a people's commune, and this was perhaps one of the most interesting experiences we had. People's commune is just a huge piece of land in which the operation is pretty self-sufficient. They take care of their own food needs, their own fiber needs. This is at least in southern China, where the climate is such that that's possible. They have 3 crops of rice and 1 crop of wheat every year. The land is just being used over and over again. There's not an inch that is uncultivated. Now they don't have very much in the way of farm implements at all. They're very proud about the farm implements that they do have. We saw some Chinese manufactured farm implements on display, and they looked like the kind of thing that was common in this country before the Depression. I mean, they're just small and old-fashioned and so on. But we never saw any in operation. All cultivation was done by hand. Or, let's put it this way, the most mechanized thing I ever saw was a kind of rice thresher. You pick the rice by hand, and then you have what looks like just a big steel barrel, and you hold the rice and put it on top, and then there's kind of a treadle, and you jump on it like this, and it beats the rice out. Okay? And so you save a little energy and do a little bit better job. But that was the most mechanized farm work that we saw. Everything is done by hand, and people are lined up in long rows, cultivating, picking, and so on and so forth, traveling around the paddies in little non-motorized boats and so on. The water buffalo is used quite a bit to pull the plows and so on and so forth. But their productivity yields are pretty high. They're higher than some other places in Asia where the use of farm implements is far greater. Now I have this written down, I can't remember exactly the ratio, but if you were to compare the rice productivity per hectare in the Philippines with rice productivity per hectare in People's Republic, where in the Philippines they're quite mechanized, nevertheless the productivity in the and have the advantage of a lot more in the way of petrochemicals and so on. Still, the productivity per hectare, at least in southern China, is higher than it is in the Philippines. And these figures are, as far as I know, not distorted for propaganda purposes. Those figures are provided by places like International Rice Research Institute and so on. Factories form a part of a people's commune. The commune we visited had no particular natural resources. I mean, There was no petroleum or coal or anything like that, but they had a couple of assembly plants there. They made lathes. They did the casting and then the assembling and so on. It was very interesting going through these because there seemed to be just such a casual the way you might putter around in your basement if you were going to put a lathe together some winter atmosphere. I mean, it was very disorganized. People were sort of working at their own pace and so on. We were struck because there were no safety precautions taken. People did not. There was a lot of filing and sparks and, you know, metal pieces flying and so on. But nobody wore goggles. Nobody wore safety shoes. Nobody wore gloves. Nothing like this. People wore fairly loose clothing if you get caught in things and so on. And so we asked, don't you have accidents or so on? He said, no, we don't have accidents. You don't have accidents if you're devoted, if you're committed to the cause, you see, and if you follow in the line of Marxist, Leninist, Mao Tse-tung thought, and want to let a thousand flowers bloom, you won't have accidents. I mean, this is the kind of answer we got all the time. They were making lathes, and I don't know enough about these kinds of things to say whether they were really efficient or not, but there was some kind of quota system and incentive to produce these lathes, and they were. We visited a hospital in the people's community, or what was called a hospital. They have in China what are known as barefoot doctors. Barefoot doctors are what we would call, I guess, paramedicals or something. They're not really trained physicians, but they have some kind of medical training. They're also fairly well-versed in the folk medicines of China. There's a great deal of interest in keeping alive these folk medicines, particularly that was the case under Mao Tse-tung, who said that, you know, we're going to stand on our own two feet. But even now, under Hua, where there's an interest in importing as much Western technology as possible, still the interest is to keep alive these traditional forms of medicine. That means herbal medicine, and that means acupuncture. So that when you visit a people's commune hospital, and the hospital is not as well appointed as the Holden Village Hospital, you will see them dealing with all sorts of illnesses through a combination of the herbal acupuncture and modern Western techniques. Herbal medicine, it's hard for me to say just, you know, what it is or what it's about, because I wouldn't know the names of the herbs in English, and that was one term that they couldn't translate into English anyway. We'll have dried herbs which will be applied directly to wounds or something. They will take them and distill them into liquid form for injections, they're in that way trying to combine the old techniques of herbal medicines with modern techniques and so on. They're preserving them in ampules and so on. Saw a display of acupuncture going on, very highly accepted and widely practiced technique. One thing that was done in this hospital, and I didn't know that it was ever a part of acupuncture, but again, it illustrates the sense in which the old traditional medicine and the new technology are being combined, was that some of the needles, they had electric current rolling through. So that in addition to the strict acupuncture, there was also something else. In some respects, program to synthesize the traditional medicine with Western medicine seems to work more effectively than the program, let's say, in Taiwan, where you have Western medicine and then you have traditional medicine, which is regarded simply as superstition officially, but which a lot of people believe in. And so you see this, you see in Taiwan very often people who are in need of medical treatment trying to be cured by traditional means and not getting any serious medical attention. For example, if you walk around Taipei, you'll find these little stores, storefront kinds of places, in which there will be pictures out in front, large photographs of some sort of ailment. Okay? People will walk around and diagnose themselves. They see a picture of something, and that's what they've got. Then they go into this storefront. It really isn't a storefront in Western fashion with glass, but really an open stall. They go in this open stall and sit down on a little bench, and somebody will lay some herbs on and so on. It's a not sanitary, and it's done in the most haphazard way, and done by people who are there simply to make money and so on. So it's a very exploitive kind of thing, and there are a lot of people who, because they believe so much in traditional medicine, never get any real medical attention. They simply won't go into the modern Western, you see, medical facility. In the People's Republic, by bringing them together and having them work side by side and sort of using a both-and approach, I think that there's probably a better general delivery of medical care than there is in some other places in Asia. Also the use of the barefoot doctor, again a paramedical person doing things that, in our society you couldn't do it, but I mean when you're so short on doctors it seems to be a very effective way to deliver some kind of medical services. Chinese, and this I only know from conversation and reading, but the Chinese of course are doing a lot of medical research now. It too is interestingly enough very ideologically oriented. There is a song, and we heard the song sung by a group of school children, and then it was translated for us, about Chinese cancer research. The song says that we've got to wipe out cancer for the people, this is now possible because of the defeat of the Gang of Four. You see. Somehow the two go together. The Gang of Four were for cancer, and now we're beyond it, against cancer. So, so everything is ideologically oriented in this way and translated into song and drama and so on and so forth. I've read subsequently that there have been some significant breakthroughs, for example, in cancer research in the People's Republic. We visited the preschool on the People's Commune. Both parents, of course, are working at their assigned tasks, and so children are cared for all day long at different kinds of child care facilities, segregated roughly by age. For the very young babies, and this is a case not only on communes, but also in factories in the cities, let's put it this way, to illustrate the point. In the child care facilities, in the factories in the cities, the mother and the child will be in the same factory, the mother will be permitted to visit her baby during the day and nurse her baby and so on right on the job, so that there's a certain preservation of the infant-mother bonding that's encouraged and preserved, even though the children are placed outside of the family in child care facilities for a young age. We visited a group of kids of 3, 4, and 5 years old. As we arrived to the playground, sort of like going in the playground here next to Narnia, the kids were all out, and they were dressed up in their festive costumes, very bright, the girls very brightly colored skirts, the boys in usually blue pants and white shirts, and then they all had flowers around their neck, something like the Hawaiian leis. And they were lined up, making a gate for us to pass through, sort of an honor guard. And they were just chanting, "Welcome, welcome, welcome, welcome." We went in, and they had a performance ready for us of songs. Really astounding. First of all, these kids all just seemed to be born performers. There was no evidence that any one of them had the least bit of self-consciousness or shyness or reticence. They would stand up, they would sing their hearts out. There wasn't anything that we could do that would embarrass them, apparently. I mean, saying hello, what's your name, you're cute, this kind of stuff. That in our culture, in our society, this one up here will grab on my leg if one of you will ask him to say good morning sometimes. But nothing like that. Singing songs, for example, a song choreographed showing some kind of struggle and battle, and the words of the song being, "We have got to fight," of course, to defeat the Gang of Four, because that was part of every song, but also to be reunited with our lost brothers and sisters in Taiwan. Right? 3-4-year-olds singing this. They gave us a demonstration of martial arts. They did a number of folk dances. As you know, there are a number of different culture groups in China itself, and one of the great tasks of anybody who's going to rule all of China is to somehow unify the country. And so the Mongols and so on need to be brought into mainstream Chinese culture. And so the kids are learning the traditional folk dances from all of the different culture groups in China, and we had a display of that. And then, of course, the words that they sing at the same time, indicating that we are all brothers together, we all love our wise chairman, Hua, and together we're going to defeat the forces of imperialism and so on. So that if one wonders, you see, about how you get people to have this sort of burning, fervent, revolutionary outlook that I mentioned, the guides in the museum had, I guess you get it by educating in this fashion. Now, since I'm talking about schools, let me talk about the secondary school we visited. The secondary school was not on the People's Commune. It was in the city of Canton, because there are some parallels between what this preschool was like and what the school is like there. And then also it's interesting to compare that middle school with our own school system. We were able to visit classes in English. In English, big class, 75 pupils, sitting 2 to a desk, and sharing their textbooks. The mode of instruction being the teacher saying a phrase and the students answering in chorus with the appropriate reply, back and forth like this. Looked very carefully. There were quite a few who were just sort of, mumbling and not participating, and just sort of getting by. As far as we could tell, there was a lot of likelihood that they would never be put on the spot. So that perhaps might explain the pretty poor level of English that is attained. English is the only language they're teaching now in the secondary schools, and level of accomplishment even among those who do very well and major in English at the university is pretty poor. And I think simply has to do with the fact that their teaching methods are really outmoded, and the classes are so large that there's no opportunity for individual attention. We went to an art class, and extraordinary exhibit of the work that the kids had done, and just really beautiful, sensitive, lovely things. But then we watched the kids working and saw that what they were doing, what constituted their art education, was simply copying. Practically, they were practically indistinguishable from each other. But that was it. I mean, the idea of free expression was absolutely ruled out. It was copying. Copying drawings or paintings of heroes, a very popular motif. I asked, do you ever work directly from a live model? Oh, no. Well, why not? Well, you can't expect the students to be able to see in the model what's truly there, you see. But in this illustration, somehow been, you know, if they just follow that, then they will show this kind of revolutionary, optimistic expression. Okay, and that's important. So that technically, these kids were amazing in terms of free expression, no evidence of it at all. Went to a chemistry class, well, there was very little equipment, some demonstrations of chemical reactions were performed by the teacher up front, pretty much like high school chemistry that I had. The only difference was that the kids in the class probably got none or very little hands-on experience. They simply didn't have the equipment. Went to what was called a mathematics class. I think there was a translation problem there because it wasn't mathematics, it was more like engineering drawing or mechanical drawing. And we saw that. We were told that this is how we're learning geometry, and isn't it wonderful, because immediately we're able to make application of it, and this very practical oriented approach. I suspect that there may have been some other instruction in mathematics that we didn't see. Physical education. At a certain time, bell rings and everybody assembles out in the courtyard, and they line up, rows of boys, rows of girls. Somebody stands up in the front and over the speaker gives some commands, and they go through various of the traditional Chinese calisthenics. Very funny sorts of things to look at from a Western perspective, because there's not very much motion. What simply look like eccentric gestures. Certainly there's some physiological justification for it. At any rate, done in absolute precision, and then there was a period in which they did kind of exercising and marching and so on and so forth, and that was physical education. That was her instruction. Free time, immediately. We're there with students. Ah, you're from America, you play basketball. You want to play us in basketball? They're easy to beat. A great deal of interest in that, and not taught in the school, but not discouraged either. The one sport that everybody in China seems to be pretty good at is ping pong. And everywhere you go, there'll be a ping pong table set up. And some of our students thought they were pretty good at ping pong, would challenge someone to a game. And our students always got whooped. The most feeble-looking person would just really be good at table tennis. Again, on physical education activity, Augustana College may have done its bit toward international understanding and world peace by having introduced the Frisbee to the People's Republic of China. At least we brought some in, nice big Swedish frisbees. And apparently no one had ever seen them before. I'm really excited. We taught people how to do it. And just loved it, you know. Thought it was the funniest game they had ever seen. And then we gave the frisbees away. So I mean, in a few years there'll be very inexpensive frisbees on the market from China, and you'll know why. Then we went to a musical performance that they put on for us. This is then on the high school level, again, very, very much a propaganda show, but very talented. There was a young boy there. Actually, he was, I'll never forget him because he was an albino Chinese. But he was a violinist who was just really remarkably good. Now, the Chinese violin pieces that they played for us, I mean, they said they were Chinese, but one, I'm sure that it was Tchaikovsky. It was just changed a little bit, because one of the rules is things can't be in minor keys, and you can't have any, you know, sort of diminished chords and so on. So they just changed those. You know, it's kind of major key, so on. But with those kinds of, then it became, you know, a Chinese revolutionary piece, optimistic and nice, you know, with no apologies, by the way, to Tchaikovsky. They liked to sing. Then they did some jokes. They had a Chinese folk song which was set to the tune of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which they sang for us. We all had it, and they knew that that was stolen. I mean, they all did. And we all laughed about that. I guess I was ignorant. I was a little bit surprised to find that the most popular musical instrument in China is, well, let me ask, let's see, maybe I'm not so naive as I, what do you think the most popular musical instrument in China is? What?
Accordion.
That's it, yeah, the accordion. Everybody goes, whip out the accordion. And, you know, but violin and accordion duets. Okay. Everywhere we went, before we did anything else, we had to sit down in a room. We were given tea and cigarettes for a briefing. So you enter a room, you enter a place, and you're ushered into a room, and the Chinese are clapping. And we learned soon enough the appropriate response is to clap in return. After a while, I'm not sure how this happens, but it's appropriate to stop clapping. You sit down, and there's tea, and just really awful, I was told, cigarettes. The Chinese seem to love cigarettes. They're just really, many of them, terrific chain smokers. You're drinking tea, and you're having a briefing. Briefing means a political explanation of what it all means. Now, whenever you go into one of these rooms, and in fact, almost any room that you go into, you will see, say if it were this room, there would be right there a large color photograph of Chairman Mao. Next to him would be a large color photograph of Chairman Hua. Over here, a smaller black and white photo of Karl Marx looking over, you see, a picture of Engels looking over. Over here, a picture of Lenin looking over, and a picture of Joe Stalin looking over, okay? Looking to them for the inspiration and leadership and wisdom and so on. In every room you go into, Stalin isn't mentioned much, his picture is everywhere. After Mao decided that Stalinization was not going to work in China, people no longer talk about it. The phrase that you hear over and over again is Marxist-Leninist Mao Tse-Tung thought. And that's, you know, the spirit of salvation. Marxist-Leninist Mao Tse-Tung thought. And all you have to do is be true to that, you see, and social difficulties will be resolved. We were always told that China had a lot of problems, and that if these problems were to be resolved, that it was going to take the cooperation and hard work and study meaning Marxist, Lenin, Mao Zedong, of everyone, and that they were constantly rededicating themselves to this task. We were told that, and this again reflects what I was calling the kind of current cultural revolution, and we were told now that what China needs from the West is technology. We were told that this is what Mao Zedong preached. It's not what Mao Zedong preached. It's what, in a way, is the difference between the Gang of Four and the current regime. But we were told, at any rate, that this was consistent, and this is what they wanted from us. What they could give to us, however, had something to do with the quality of life, had to do with steadfastness of purpose, integrity, and so on. We would ask questions every time we had a briefing. We would ask questions. We would ask the same questions in different places. And if we asked the same question here and the same question there, we always got precisely the same answer. This revolutionary committee and that revolutionary committee had apparently been given the appropriate answer, word for word, and it just came back, so that there's a great deal of uniformity of political thought. We went to the ballet, the Peking Ballet, which, by the way, I think is touring the United States this next season, was in Canton performing, saw a ballet about about a tree that was really happy because it was going to be made part of a large memorial in Peking to Chairman Mao. It was a very exciting, a lot of singing, pastel colors, very romantic kind of drama and music and so on. Very sort of syrupy, you know. And the whole thing was how, the whole story was about how this tree was just really delighted to be chosen to be part of the monument to Mao Zedong. We saw another one about Mao's first wife, who was who's now being venerated as really a true leader, in contrast to the widow of Mao, who was one of the Gang of Four, and the first wife, of course, was killed, and she's being made into quite a revolutionary immortality. Both ballets ended, to my surprise, with a strong sort of pitch for revolutionary immortality. And all of a sudden, everyone is taken up into kind of this heaven, you see, and there's light colors are changing, and there's choir music, and it's like everyone has become angels, and this is the spirit, you see, you know, that's where it's leading, and you know, dedicate your life and sort of aim toward this kind of happiness. The audience, when this would happen, they just ooh and ah and so on. An interesting feature of the performance was the audience's reaction. It's very cheap to go there. We were given what we were told were the very best seats in the house. Anyway, the front center, I mean, about 8th or 10th row or something like that. And those seats would have sold for 40 cents each. Everything else we said we were told was less expensive. Yeah. And I'm sure that when the Peking Ballet is in American cities, you won't see it for 40 cents. The audience is there. It's, you know, therefore not an elite crowd, but everybody. They've mostly come on bicycles. You don't see cars. in China. There's no private ownership of cars. The only cars you see, and you think they're private cars, but it turns out they're taxis. If you ever see a car in China, you hail it, it'll turn out to be a taxi. So they're all there on bicycles. As soon as the thing was over, they know the stories. They know the stories. As soon as the thing is over, big auditorium. This is in the Sun Yat-sen Memorial Hall. Big auditorium. Emptied almost immediately. People just filed right out, vroom. By the time, we were done sort of speaking to each other about, gee, wasn't that interesting, and so on, the place was empty. And on their bicycles and gone. They didn't clap either. Well, a couple of claps. As it clap when you, clapping has a different function. We went to a culture park, a people's culture park. I guess in most Chinese cities they have such things. Big stage up in front with a series of performances going on, musical performances and little sketches. And we had people translating for us, and the sketches all had to do, were all satirical sketches about the Gang of Four. And everybody was getting quite a few laughs about that. In the culture park, there was also an art museum or art gallery, and I went through that. And the first hall was dedicated to showing the sort of preordained transfer of power from Chairman Mao to Chairman Hua. Now, I mean, you don't need to know very much to know that this was not really all that easy a transition. But in the big illustrations that they had, it was there, and they show the young Chairman Hua sort of sitting at the knee of Mao, and Mao kind of planning how he's going to pass the torch to Hua, and so on. And the idea, as it were, that there was a kind of natural succession here, that it couldn't have been otherwise. And so that was the official story being told by way of large illustrations for the many in the culture park. Then there was a very nice gallery beyond that with a lot of Chinese nature paintings, that some of which were very, very nice. In the culture park, there were a lot of displays of the recent achievements under, in a sense of revolution, photographs of success in things like oil exploration and so on. There was a kind of aquarium there, except that it looked more like a biology storeroom, these big jars filled with formaldehyde with fish in it. There's something very pathetic about that, but anyway, went through that and saw the species of fish that were indigenous to the lakes and seas. Then the final thing I want to say that we visited was the Chinese International Export Commodities Fair. This is held twice a year in Canton. China now is very, very interested in trading with the rest of the world. They've got to have some money that's usable on the international market. The Chinese currency is no good outside of China, and so that export trade is becoming very important. They've signed recently a large agreement with Japan, and they've also got a kind of agreement with the common market now. At any rate, we saw the wide variety of products that are being exported. They have, it seems to make almost everything in China. smaller scale, heavy machinery, looking like things produced in this country or Europe many years ago. They make a lot of clothing, make a lot of toys, small electrical appliances, and so on. They make pianos, one of our students sat up at the grand piano on demonstration at the Chinese Export Commodities Fair and played Scott Joplin for a while to the great amusement of most of the people there. There's a very strong attempt now to trade with other countries. Met some Western businessmen who were trying to make deals with the Chinese, and who were just really exasperated about the Chinese way of doing business. Because what you do is you sit down at a little table out on the main floor of the exhibition hall and have a cup of tea and kind of talk to each other for a while. And the Western businessmen have a lot of trouble figuring out what's going on. But what is really happening, as I understand it, is the Chinese are sizing them up. Are these people that they're, you know, willing to do business with and so on? If they like you, and you don't know why, it's kind of like some sort of judgment from criteria that you don't understand, there's usually an invitation extended to meet in a smaller conference room, semi-private kind of thing. Perhaps later that day, perhaps the next day. I think it'll take a long time. There'll be several days of negotiations and so on. Met some British businessmen, rode in on the train talking to one of them. It was his third visit to the commodity fair. He was going crazy because he just couldn't, you know, close the deal. And every indication he got, and this commodity fair, by the way, you know, it only goes every 6 months, you see. So, I mean, he's been trying to close the deal now for 18 months. What he wants to do is buy some kind of nut and bolt arrangement from the Chinese that they can make very cheaply that he will use in some machines that he's making in England, see. It's enough cheaper that it's worth making the trip from London to Canton every 6 months until he can close his deal. But he was just really exasperated. He was like, I don't know. A big thing and an intense push to try and sell their products. And one struck with the sort of, you feel as though you're going into the past and buying, you know, products that you would have expected to buy 20 or 30 years ago. Things just look that different. Now, finally, just kind of a comment on the personal relationships that we were able to develop with some Chinese people. We had the two official guides, interpreters, who met us down in Shumchun. But when we got up to Canton, we were met, there were 50 of us, and we had assigned an additional 11 interpreters. So that we had 13 for the 50 of us, and so we were able to get to know them reasonably well. The 11 that were assigned to us were just recent university graduates. They were practically the same age as all of our students, very quickly a kind of empathy and closeness began to develop. It began, there was protocol and so on and so forth, but American students don't understand that very well and didn't play that game, and very quickly, because of the common age and so on, that began to the formality of the relationship began to break down. Things like the throwing the frisbee around with these guys helped, playing ping pong with them helped. When we invaded the friendship store and all bought these Red Army hats and started wearing those around, if you have a group of Swedish businessmen, they don't do this, you see. And that's the kind of groups that these kids had been leading around before. So that, again, there was a kind of opening. A lot of our students bought the whole outfit, you know, and were wearing these things around. And, what happened was some of the kids just developed very, very close relationships, it seemed. And they somehow understood something about each other. The Chinese students told us that they didn't really like the job that they had. I don't think that they're supposed to say this. It's not commensurate with the idea of revolutionary optimism, you know. But they said, no, we're just assigned this job and we're not really happy. It's not very fulfilling. Well, why not? Well, because one of them said, you know, I'm just really not good enough at English. It's too frustrating. I don't have the talent. My talent would be more appropriately placed elsewhere. Questions. What's it like in America? What is it like to go to school? What do you study? Astounded at the school schedule. Well, what do you do with so much free time? The uniform belief that the amount of leisure time that Americans had was absolutely decadent. Really surprised, A, that there was so much leisure time for a university student, at least. And then the uniform reaction that this is simply decadent. They were a little bit happier when they discovered that our students had to go to work in the summer and do a job that they just weren't, you know, on vacation. But the idea of time off was a little bit surprising. The idea of travel was something which was hard for them to understand. The only reason they travel is to visit family, you see, get together. The idea of just traveling to go and see things is something that is not part of their life and doesn't occur to them. Questions about far away places like Hong Kong. Hong Kong, you know, is 80 miles away. What's it like? The most narrow sorts of stereotypes about city life, you know. Well, we understand there is absolutely no trees in Hong Kong, that there's nothing to do there, that it's not safe, and so on and so forth. Really, really astounded, you know, to talk about, you know, parks and trees and flowers and things to do and beaches and so on and so forth. Just they knew about the United States. At least they knew about American geography. They didn't know very much about American history. Now you say, well, so should they? That's impressive when you talk to students in other Asian countries who embarrassed our students by knowing more about American history than they did. But at any rate, the students in the People's Republic knew nothing about it and had a lot of very stereotyped notions about our country and about Europe and so on. Couldn't conceive of most people having cars to drive. Couldn't understand that, well, you know, the railroads were kind of going out of business in our country now, that was something that we didn't value as much as they did, or at least we didn't marvel over it in the same way that we did, and so on. Were they unhappy living in the People's Republic? No, I don't think so. Their dissatisfactions were something that they admitted in the context of being really very, very happy, convinced that the revolutionary government was really in their best interests, convinced that their life was very good and getting better, and so on. And in a way, I guess I would have to agree with them that their lives are not bad. You don't see any evidence of unemployment. You don't see any evidence of any of the social problems that one sees in all other Asian cities, or even in most cities around the world. I mean, there's you don't have squatters in Chinese cities. You don't have prostitutes. You don't seem to have a problem with alcoholism or drug abuse or anything like this. Somebody asked if alcohol was available, and yes, it's sold freely. I guess it's pretty expensive, and so people don't buy it. There's the most popular alcoholic beverage seems to be that. Now let's see if I can remember the name of it. The Chinese word, sounds sort of like Mai Tai, but it's not that. Anyway, it's a white wine brandy, something you know, when Nixon was in China and they were toasting that evening, and some of the commentators were wondering, you know, how people at the head table were making out with this stuff. And I know why now, because, you know, you get it about this close to you and it begins to burn. And it affects every single sense, I mean, just the tiniest little bit, and that's all I took. And You know, just feel it thrash your lungs in your head. So it may not be the cost, it may be that the stuff is so poisonous that people stay away from it, I don't know. But anyway, you don't see social problems like this. Walked around Canton one night and were free to walk here and there where we weren't supposed to be, and walked into very, very modest neighborhoods where families are living in one-room kinds of apartments with outside plumbing and so on, but they were cheery and clean and well-maintained and so on, people were busy. You look in the windows or something, and people were doing handwork, or they were reading, or there was something like that. So people really seemed to be happy and occupied, and so on. Same, you know, no evidence, no visible evidence, malnutrition. Go to a place like the Philippines and just heartbroken because of the number of children who are obviously malnourished. Don't see that in the People's Republic. Kids just look really healthy and well taken care of and loved and self-confident and so on. So anyway, those are some impressions from a variety of things. And I talked longer than I thought I would, I guess. But at any rate, I'm wound up now, so I can answer questions if you want to, either now or any time. Otherwise, you're free to go take your son.
Did they express to you any concern, their concerns about internal problems of the country? What are their biggest concerns about?
Food is a very big concern.
Food
is a big concern, yeah. I mean, they've just really got to work hard to feed their own people. And they can't do it. I mean, they just don't have enough. And so that's a constant struggle. Because of the need to develop every possible acre of arable land, they've just cut down all their trees, and so there's a lot of reforestation going on in order to provide timber and so on. They are concerned about holding the country together so that these sort of non-Chinese groups are being encouraged to be part of it. There's really sort of they deny that there's any problem, but the way in which they deny it, you know that there is. They need technology if they're going to be able to raise their agricultural productivity and agricultural technology. If they're going to modernize, and they seem to be determined to modernize, they're going to need a lot more in the way of energy resources and so on. Yeah.
When you spoke of this fervor that they had,
yeah,
was this a sort of fervor that was largely defensive, or do they have, say, a mission like Cuba, offensive, or what was your impression of that?
It's just as though that they feel as though that they are just really persuaded that the revolution has liberated them from the worst sort of poverty and hardship, and that the revolution is something which has got to be kept alive, they're going to do their bit.
And they feel that it's endangered in some way, a lot of problems internally, externally?
Yeah, well, what I was trying to say is that one reads that there's concern that sort of the revolutionary fervor is waning, and that when this happens that the character of society will change and that the control that they have won't any longer be possible. What I'm saying is that when one meets people and talks with them, that you don't have any feeling that, people 20 years old who didn't know anything about the revolution are anything. You don't have the feeling that they're without any fervor.
Well, I guess my question is whether this is directed toward being some sort of attack from the outside defensively, or whether this is a
Oh, I see. Look, I mean, one of the things that struck me was that China did not seem like a very militaristic place at all. And in fact, you practically saw. Now, everybody wears a uniform, and the Chinese don't, you know, worry about the kind of insignia and so on that say the Russians do. And the Chinese traditionally make a lot of fun of the Russians for doing this, and because you know, they say that we can figure out who the general is without having a lot of paraphernalia on there. So, but nevertheless, you could. I mean, even though there's not a lot of insignias, one you could tell the police and Red Army from civilians. And their presence was not very obvious at all, and one didn't have the feeling that that there was any kind of preparedness for a military attack. Similarly, if you look at the big posters that are everywhere, and since they have a real problem with literacy, a lot of this thing is just conveyed in pictures, so you don't need to be able to read Chinese to know what's on the minds of people. You don't see be prepared for some sort of military thing. In Taiwan, it was exactly the opposite. There, you know, all the time they're talking about military preparedness and reenacting the battles and talking about you know, retaking the mainland and so on and so forth. When the kids were singing the songs about you know, the need to be reunited with our revolutionary brothers and sisters in Taiwan, it was a very romantic sort of business. And so, at any rate, you know, there's not this kind of clear, hard line military talk. Now, maybe in the north it's different. Maybe in the north it's different.
Did many of the Chinese that you mingled with speak English, or do they teach English in the schools?
Yeah, they teach English. That's the only language that they teach. when we went walking around Canton and ran into people, and I went into a little factory, it was operating at night, where they were taking charcoal that had been burned in one thing and sort of compounding it into pellets, which were then used for cook stoves. And that's what the factory was. We went in there and watched the operation. Nobody there could speak a single word of English. When we went to these briefings, and here you had the elected officials of the revolutionary committees and so on, they might know a word or two of English, but if they knew any more, they didn't let on. I don't think they did. The press to teach English, I mean, I think it's, I don't know how recent, but fairly recent. I just don't think it's very effective because of the teaching techniques. And then also, you know, the idea under Mao Zedong, of course, was that very few people were, you know, going to go to the university, and that, I mean, you weren't going to develop specialists and so on and so forth. That policy is changing now, so that you may find, you know, English more widespread, but at least now they're pretty much locked into their culture because of their language.
Did anyone in your group speak Chinese?
No, and probably one of the reasons why a group like ours was admitted into the country was because they knew that we didn't have anybody who was
otherwise it'd be more difficult.
There are people, you know, living in Hong Kong, scholars of Chinese civilization and politics and so on, who just love to get in, and they just can't get a visa for love nor money.
I traveled in East Germany, and because he's speaking to people,
mm-hmm.
traveling alone, it was extremely interesting just for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can carry on these little ad hoc conversations.
And the wall placards, were any of them in romanization, or were they all in character?
The only place I saw Roman letters was at the border. Otherwise, they were all in Chinese characters. The usually profusely illustrated. The illustrations are as important as the characters, as I understand it. Yes.
I just read about Romanization being used as a teaching process to increase the learning.
Yeah, and I've read about that too. We didn't see any evidence of it in the schools that we were in, and I think that it's being done on more or less an experimental basis. But I mean, they have a real problem there. The same thing in Japan too. In trying to, if they're interested in modernizing and sort of being compatible with the Western world's technology, they're probably going to have to do something like that.
Yeah.